knowledge is something valuable, it's an operant, so it's not wasted on people who don't have character. Right? So some of the qualified knowledge is given to, that's what we discussed in the class, it's more generic, it's more open. So you're one, you're taking a risk, but generally those who don't appreciate, since it's a formal environment, will either, you know, stand up and make themselves obvious and go and speak, or stand up and leave. That. So, you know, the risk is something less, but still it's there. But it's not like you're instructing someone in technical aspects of the philosophy and that, and then having them use it improperly. Is that okay? But the main point is that it is kept simple or just straightforward for those without much character. You always try to work on the character. They have principles, you work on character. But if there's pride, then there's a limit to what you can teach. Right? Because then they'll be very, very proud of whatever their position was. I think I tell the story of Gotama's son. Gotama. So I don't know if it's one of many or one in specific. Then he went to the Gurukul because of his lineage and all that, and he was very proud, because Gotama is one of the big rishis. So he went to the Gurukul, you know, he's accomplished, very intelligent. So he finished his education and came out, he was very proud of his position. You know, so he and his associates then, it's not because they would take advantage and go around the various, you know, situations where there's discussions on, you know, shastra. So maybe one of these will always be big yagyas. So I think they went to Janaka Raj, you know, in Nepal. And because he was always doing sacrifices, so they went to one of his sacrifices. And in that, then, between the technical rituals, then they always sit and discuss philosophy with all the sadhus there and other people who come. So it's a major, like, educational environment, this one they had yagyas. So he went there, and they were, you know, so much discussion was going on. So then when the king understood the Gotama's son had come, so then he was, you know, very enthusiastic, as he thought here is, you know, a very great sage. You can tell we can learn a lot from him. You know, his Gotama's son, Gotama's so revered. So then he started asking him questions on spiritual subject matter. So Gotama's son, he had no answers. He didn't even know spiritual subject matter existed. He was expert in Vedas, expert in Brahmanas. He knew how to do the rituals, he knew all the social, you know, laws, and, you know, everything to do with the social situation. He knew that very nicely. He never even heard of spiritual subject matter, you know, Vedanta. So he got insulted and left with his associates. They came back to the ashram, and his father said, so, you know, how was the yajna and all that? And he says, this king is so uncultured, you know, and this and that. And, you know, and then Gotama was surprised that, you know, Janaka Raj is known for his character and his, you know, dedication to sacrifice and, you know, respect for the Brahmins and all that. So he's not respectful, you know, like that. And so Gotama was asking, well, why, what happened? He says, well, you know, we were having these nice discussions, and then he started asking all these, you know, just foolish questions. You know, just questions that have no idea where they, you know, it's just he's making up stuff. So Gotama was saying, that's strange. So what were his questions? And then when Gotama's son explained the questions, then Gotama Muni could understand these questions were on spiritual subject matter, you know, that were based on realization, they were taking it much further than what he had realization on. So then Gotama and his associates then got up, collected some firewood, and then went before Janaka Raj and said, you know, we've come here to be your disciples, you know. Because what you know in spiritual life is more than us, so we would like to hear from you. So he says, okay, that means I can't, you know, out of respect, I can't accept you as students, but what I can do is, you can stay as my guests, and I will discuss with you whatever I know, like that. So there is you know, he respectfully took care of them, and then they would discuss philosophy. So that's an example of, if there's pride with Veda Garbha, then what is taught is actually limited. Okay. So now there's the other example that you have of the let's see, another. Someone went, yeah, he had been around, he had studied in the school, he was also Snapaka, went around, learned from so many people. Then he came to one sage, and, you know, he said, I come here to learn, you know, all this, this, and this, because I know this, I know that, and so many things. So then the sage said, okay, then you come sit, then, you know, it's proper, you come sit, take some water. So he gave him a glass, started pouring water, and, you know, the brahmacharya is you know, following the etiquette, you know, like that. And, you know. Then the sage keeps pouring water, and then the glass gets full, you know. And then the brahmacharya, you know, and then it starts overflowing. The brahmacharya says, well, what are you doing? Can't you see that it's full and nothing more will go inside? And then the sage stopped and said, exactly. You're so full of knowledge, there's no more space to put anything more. Because of your pride. So, according to Gita, then it is by service, by menial service, by humble service, that one gets the inspiration to learn more, the one has the capacity to learn. Then, from that capacity, means so, because we're talking character, because with humility, one has the capacity to learn, one is able to acquire submissively. That submissive inquiry, then you'll actually get real benefit in the answer. Then you'll be able to apply it in your life, which is service. Right? So it's a cycle. Each one is nourishing the other. If you have an interest in the knowledge, you'll naturally ask questions that are relevant for practical application. If you ask them, you have the answer, you want to practically apply it. For practically applying it, with the proper, that knowledge and that proper service attitude, that generates more capacity to learn. So that's the Vedic system of knowledge. That's why in the Vedic education, so much emphasis is put on character development. Because otherwise, there's only so much academics you can put in. You notice, kids that don't have a good service attitude, they don't have good grades. Kids who get the 4-point average are generally the ones that are willing to work. Right? They'll work at that, they generally have more character. Right? It's just the way it is. Or a lot of motivation, so that they know if I focus, I'll get the work done. But at some point, they have a limit. Right? They'll finish their education, and that's all the farther they can go. You know? So, it's only when that element of service that is there, then there's focus. When there's focus, then one can properly endeavor. You know, they work with each other. That's why so much emphasis is put in the Vedic education process on that. Modern doesn't. Used to, because it used to be education was the occupation of the priests. You know, so the Western world, all the teachers were priests. You know, full-on practicing priest. So it was basically a study of God and God's creation. But sometime in the 1700s, I think, in the time of the quote-unquote enlightenment, then enlightenment meaning to lighten the things. So they dropped off study of God, you know, they lightened the curriculum by dropping off God and basically just study the creation. And then at that point, then it wasn't so prominent that the priests were the necessary teachers. And the time is less and less. Now you have to go more to a seminary or a specialized school where they are, you know, like a Catholic school or something, then you get priests. So then the difficulty is there isn't the concept of humility, service to God, anything like that. So it doesn't work so well.
For brahmacharya, it seems quite easy in terms of menial service to acquire the humility. So for grihasthas, if they don't get it?
Technically for grihasthas, it's simpler for a brahmachari. And the force is simple. The grihastha actually has more opportunity, broader range of opportunity. And the force is actually greater to be humble. But because it's coming rather than through the mechanics of efficiently getting something done, it's coming through the medium of emotion. Therefore, it tends to spark emotion and it seems harder. You know what I'm saying? But the opportunities for menial service is actually greater. Because in for the brahmachari, it's only that you've taken the instruction, then you go off and do it. You know, in other words, if the attitude is respectful during the instruction, you know, and you work okay with the others, then that's enough. That's all that's expected. That's all the emotional pressure that's there. But the other one is at all times, at all places, at all circumstances, one that must be submissive. You know what I'm saying? So it's actually, the opportunity is greater, but it's, and without training, then the ability to perceive that is very, very minimal. It's less than a brahmachari. But if one is a good brahmachari, then generally it's easier to see that and one gets great advantage. So one is able to, through that humility, work with it, understand it, be able to work with, deal with it with that understanding. And so then one gets a lot of realization. The idea is that brahmachari could, in this situation, besides getting understanding, get realization. If he gets realization, generally there's no need to get married. If he doesn't, he only has understanding, then he turns to household life for that realization. That's what it's for. Then the Naisika brahmachari and the Upakurvana brahmachari, they come to the same platform. Like that, they have the same realization. Just one's got it within the ashram in a shorter time, and the other one has a bit of a detour, but that detour was meant to realize the same principles.
And Vanaprastha is
the natural state. Vanaprastha is the natural state after the ashram. So basically, it comes because of the realization. So then you actually understand what is the important elements of grihastha ashram. You know, and that is basically your element of companionship, service, you know, sadhana, knowledge, you know, hosting guests. You know, the more aspects that are devotionally, spiritually beneficial within the grihastha ashram. And that camaraderie to perform those services. So it's the natural stage from the grihastha ashram. But in any case, it's that because of the detachment, there is the element that it's harder to become proud. But generally, that's already been worked out before. The sannyasa, you're dealing with indifference, so that indifference needs to also generate that you can't be proud of, that it's going to work properly. Because pride means that I'm doing or I'm successful, you know, so that means I value that. So it's not actually the proper position, you know what I'm saying? So in any case, that will be developed from the indifference, you know, from the constant changing of environments and all that. In other words, the brahmachari lives in a very secure, constant environment. You know, the grihastha, in one sense, is a secure field, but what's going to happen, one has absolutely no idea. That same facility is there in the sannyas, but there, you're secured in that you know your mentality and by what you're dealing with, but the actual environment you apply it in will always be changing. So it's kind of a reversal of the grihastha situation. You know, but it still has the same effect. And the vanaprastha is basically in between, like that, because you set up a set thing, you have your option for that. But you're just dealing, controlling the senses. So that's fixed, but, you know, the focus is on that rather than what you're going to do with them. You know what you're going to do with them. You're reducing the interaction. So it, one would have to become an intolerant to be able to do that. It's like one of the things that they'll do is, you're, you know, especially if you're following very strict, you know, out of the forest, is that you subject yourself to the nature, you know, to the point where it doesn't bother you. When it's raining, you go outside. You know, we go inside, they go outside. You know, stuff like that. So they become used to just the difficulties that come up, and they become their conditions.
So, unfortunately, I haven't heard all of the classes you've given. I was just wondering if you could sort of give a brief synopsis of what are the key elements of relationships.
What are the key elements of the relationship? Basically, a relationship, you're dealing with three aspects. The relationship itself, how is the proper interaction within the relationship, and what are the natural results that would be gained from that. And in the relationship itself, then you have two key aspects. The field in which means the relationship, the definition of it, the field in which it's in. Right? Because there's an environment in which that relationship is expressed. It is the element of the relationship. So understanding the technicalities of it. The other is actually having that interest or drive to work in that relationship. Because otherwise, if you create the field, you don't have the interest. Also a problem. You know what I'm saying? So one understands these three elements, you know, which, you know, the relationship itself has those two. So if one understands these four aspects, then it works very nicely. You know, so depending upon what it is, there's a different definition. But the main principle is that having defined it, that means it defines who you are and what your duties are, what the other person is, you perform those duties consistently, that will make things work nicely. Now, if you want to improve the quality, then you have to add the element of sacrifice, which means you're working, voluntarily working for someone else's satisfaction. Right? So the performance of your duties then is being done for other satisfaction. So specifically the Supreme Lord, but whoever else you're working with, because the medium is the relationship with these other persons. So you're performing the duty properly to please the Lord. The element of sacrifice is there, the results are also for pleasing the Lord. But because the medium is in a specific relationship that you're dealing with in this environment, or in any environment, therefore whoever you're dealing with, it must be according to their needs. Right? If you're doing a sacrifice, you're trying to please them, that means their needs, so based on how it works for them. So if that's very clear, then, you know, it works. So the quality of all of them is there. You have knowledge, you have focus, you properly perform the activity without the desire for the result. And in that way, then the relationship goes right.
That actually they're really, really proud. What do they do about that?
What do they do about it? No, because once you realize it, means once you understand it, then you can work with it. Before you understand it, you can't work with it. that's the strongest that they know of. So now take 1/10,000th of a tip of the hair, and then take 2 meters of dead matter. So who's moving it around?
Salt.
The salt. That 1/10,000th, that makes it the strongest thing that there is. Think about it. 1/10,000th of a tip of the hair, not the root, the tip. That's pretty small. And it's going to push around, you know, 75, 80 kilos of, you know, dead matter. You know what I'm saying? So, who's doing it? Under the direction of the Lord. So that means the only thing that the living entity is doing is desiring. Now think about it. Okay, I have a little baby. Can a little baby, a little small baby, do anything? No, but it has a desire. It wants to eat, it wants to sleep, it wants to this or that. So who does it for them?
Yeah.
Right. So can they become proud?
Maybe.
Means, here you can, but what's there to be proud of?
Much.
Yeah. So that's the reality. So why be proud? Even if you're doing great service, who are you doing that service for? Yourself? Your grandma?
Spiritual master.
Okay, so you're going to the spiritual master, you're going to Krishna, so then the results are there. So if you're working for someone else, how can you be so proud? So that combination that you're a servant makes it hard to be proud, and that even as a servant, you still can't do anything anyway, it's still arranged by Krishna. You get the credit, but it's still arranged by Krishna. And even your work operating something, the laws is that you're operating. Yeah. So from all sides, it doesn't leave a whole lot of opportunity.
That means if you see that pride and the bad qualities and somewhere within you there is a desire to get rid of those, then Krishna will take care of the rest.
Yes, you just have to maintain that desire to get rid of them. So the more consistent the desire, the more consistent they go away.
So that desire to get rid of it would probably be based on the association of,
yeah,
of, you know, devotees.
Yeah, association of devotees. Means proper endeavor. You know, knowledge, all these things combined. Yeah. So that's why it says it's like acknowledged, and the first principle is given out of the 20 aspects of humility. So this humility, you can actually gain knowledge, you can work with knowledge. That's how it
happens. Yeah. Okay. I have another question about chanting.
Chanting.
For a lot of your class, you've been talking about the dynamics of relationships and how they work, and different qualities that you should have. And then we also hear that just by chanting, one develops all these good qualities. So why would we talk about all these other factors?
Why would we talk about these other factors? Because you went down to the shop and picked that particular chatter out and wear it in your particular way, so that's why we talk about it. You're not just sitting there chanting and whatever drops in your lap, and that's what you work with. When you go to the shop, you go to the shop and you pick out, I'll take this and I'll take that. You don't just sit there and chant, and while you're chanting, the other devotees in the temple bring you some shop. So you're making endeavor in everything. And then you expect that just the chanting, you know, happens. You understand? So when you are just chanting, then you don't have to worry about all these other things. It's not important. But because you are worrying about these other things, therefore they're important. You know what I'm saying? If you just sit here and don't deal with the car, why do you need to know anything about the car? But since you want to go out and drive the car, better you know what you're doing. You know what I'm saying? So if we're just chanting, then why most people in this room are married. You know what I'm saying? So therefore, since they're married, should they know something about what they're doing? That's the point. Okay. Point is it will come, but at the same time, there's offenses to be avoided. Because they may come, and then you remove them by your offensive chanting. And you look at most of the philosophical elements about how you deal with Vaishnavas, don't blast them, don't deal wrongly. In other words, the dissatisfaction of Vaishnavas doesn't make it tough for your spiritual life. So then how to deal with Vaishnavas? Said the association of devotees is most important. So why not develop that? Etiquette is important. We say etiquette, you know, that everybody, you know, okay, yeah, I heard that, okay, so, you know, I keep my right hand, you know, I don't pick my nose, you know, while I'm talking to somebody, you know, and stuff like that. And that's where it ends. But etiquette is to be applied to everything in God's creation. So we don't apply it. We get in our car, we're upset, we hit the gas, we screech out of here, we almost hit the car on the way out. That's not etiquette. So what's going wrong? So if you look at all our problems, basically come from a lack of etiquette. The etiquette's just then boiled down to, you know, a couple of things, you know, how I do with Vaishnava things. It's kind of Hinduian, a little bit fanatic, because, you know, I'm a Western and I've always grown up, and that's a natural thing anyway. You know, I like eating my sandwich in both hands and getting the stuff all down the front of my shirt. You know, it looks great. So, so since we're dealing with all this, and we don't actually give etiquette any credential, therefore, if you crash in from the metaphysical platform, make it very uncomfortable for people, you know, intellectually and emotionally, then you have two possibilities. Because you're making it uncomfortable because you're showing actually how to get exactly what you want, and the way you're doing it is exactly opposite of that. So then you have two possibilities here. One, they might think, okay, maybe I should take this seriously and practice it this way. And not only that, make the step that this is also our philosophy and our culture. And it's logical, it's practical, and so it would be really hard to throw this out of just some of my Western versus Vedic sentiment. Or two, I can become very, very upset and angry at why someone is poking one of the most uncomfortable aspects of my life, that I am dying due to lack of relationship, and I have no idea how to go about it, but I will try my little modernistic little foolish techniques and fail, and I don't want anyone rocking my little boat. So these two opportunities are there, and this is generally two reactions I'm getting. So if we're trying to establish Vaishnava etiquette, we can talk philosophy, then it's all been there, done that. We can talk culture, oh, that's ancient, that doesn't apply now. I talk metaphysics, you cut right through all the BS. And then there it is, sitting right in your face, that you do this, your life has the possibility to work, and the whole reason your life is going to hell is because you're not following anything that we're saying. It makes it a little stark. You know, and since we're in the age where everyone's talking truthness and, you know, being open and sharing, so I thought I'd try using it. Unfortunately, the ones that actually advocate this hate this now, because they actually are not interested in truth. All they're interested in is being able to tell you what they think about you in all negative terms, and then you shouldn't get upset. That's actually what truth means. It doesn't mean speaking real truth, because that hurts you. fact, everybody else will be glad if you start acting like that. So it's effective, but unfortunately, sometimes brutal. But it's a risky take. As a teacher, we risk that. Many people appreciate it, many people criticize it extremely strongly. The ones that extremely criticize it, generally the ones that have the most problem with this, and they don't want to admit it, that it's their fault. It's got to be everyone else's fault. Like that. So they bury themselves in their modernistic, little moralistic, judicial, you know, platforms. But we're talking, you know, just how relationships work on any platform. Material or spiritual, so they don't have an out to say, well, that doesn't work, it works right now, it's working right now. Is that okay? Makes sense. So that's why I represent this stuff. Because I guarantee if you just talk about relationships you're having not working, we can just take what we're saying and the reason is that you're not following the same thing.
Is there any literature which kind of explains how to actually practically apply and how to follow each particular different types of etiquette between in different situations in life?
Yeah, we have two good ones right here. Nectar Devotions from my Bible college. Chaitanya Charitamrita also does that. Bhagavad Gita is giving the metaphysics that we're talking about. This is the point. Right? If you look at it in its complete form, you see all these things. What is the philosophy? What is the culture? How I should deal? Right? That makes sense. So that's a block, and that's the reason it came. So it's just that it kind of fits. And that's what we're dealing with. We're not taking these out of self-help books and this and that, coming to kind of these literatures.
What about on a larger scale, like, for example, nations and their relationships? How could you explain that? On an individual basis, understand what you're saying in society, how to deal with everybody, but how about on the worldview from a basic perspective?
The same principle. You know, it's like you're dealing with the other country according to their needs, or you're dealing according to your needs, right? You know, when the 60-year-old lady with the big fancy hat goes in and sits down at the head of state at the other place, what is she there for? Trying to work out something really so comparable with the other country so they're comfortable? Or simply just trying to get their own needs and just bring it as close to the line so it doesn't only push it to the red button? Still, it's the same principle. Is the government actually trying to take care of its people, protect its people, according to their needs? Or, you know, is it more convenient to open casinos so they can get high taxes? Hard liquor, so they can get high taxes. You know that hard liquor you go down and pay, you know, $80, $100 for, probably costs about $5 to make. And then the bottle's probably more expensive than the thing. But who gets that, you know, $80? Government. The guy who makes it, he makes it as natural, whatever it is, 20, 50%, even 100%. Right? So he gets his $20, who gets the other? So it's the same principle. We're talking relation, we're talking God's relation with his creation, so that's a little bit even bigger than natural. Right? We're talking the fundamentals of relationship. Then, how you apply it, that's detail. You apply it in your business, you apply it to a country, you apply it to your wife, you apply it to, you know, you and your shoes, it's still the same principle. You don't know who you are, you don't know what the shoes are, you don't know what your relationship is, how you're going to tie the shoelaces, how you're going to have them on. You know? So if you don't know what the universe is, you don't know who you are, you don't know what your relationship is, how you manage it, how you be Indra, how you be Brahma. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, that's the same thing. We're talking about the eternal principle of relationship. And that's the basis of our philosophy. Lord Chaitanya said, the Vedic literature, this is what you're discussing. Something about the Vedic literature. We just take it as a philosophical statement. But it said relationship, process, and solve. That's very personal. That's what we do. What's our relationship with something? What we, how we deal with it? What result we get from it? And we do in everything, every aspect of our life that we apply this. But we don't think that we can apply this according to the philosophy.
How to implement that in such a modern, you know, so-called advanced society where everybody's just so...
It's the same principle. Yeah. You bring me a karmi couple, I can explain this to them, and it would be like, you know, you turn the lights on. Because they're just looking at it, I'm looking for something that will work. But devotees, you know, always made it, you can't work with mana. But the point is how do you define mana? How would you define mana?
Well, personally, myself, elevated consciousness, but I mean modernistic
in... Means you use the word modern society.
I mean what they think is modern.
So how do you define
Well, technology, basically, they think...
Technology. Maya Dhanam is more technology.
Yeah, I understand from our perspective, but I mean...
No, but what is our perspective?
I don't understand myself, but I'm saying I understand the basic.
You understand the concept.
Yeah, the concept.
I'll give you a simple definition. This is given by Rig Muni to the sages in Arjuna. Modern means not Vedic. You understand? Because Vedic is eternal. Because Vedic means God and His creation and His laws. Right? So if gravity works today, it worked 1,000 years, it still works today. That's because it's eternal. So Vedic is eternal. What's not Vedic then means I don't see it from the Vedic perspective, so I'm dealing with past, present, and future. So it's temporary. It's a very simple definition. So modern is still within the context of God's creation and God's laws. The only difference is the perspective. The only difference between today and 5,000 years ago is the perspective. That's all. Nothing else has changed. How you eat, how you sleep, how you mate, how you defend. It's the same principle. Nothing's changed. You have a war, the idea is kill the other guys. Now if you do it with a machine gun or if you do it with a sword, it doesn't matter. Economics, you buy something for cheaper than what you're going to sell it for, you're a problem. You can't change that principle. Why? Because that's God's principle. That's eternal principle. So all that changes is the perception. People don't see God in what they do. That's all the only difference. Nothing else has changed. So this whole fluff that is so different and so this and insurmountable, that's just weakness. We people say that. Prabhupada went right in there and changed it. He took hardcore, you know, intoxicated, you know, fornicating, you know, idiots out of the gutter and made them into preachers instantaneously. And everybody else went in tiptoeing around their modernity and, you know, keeping them in their place and not disturbing and all that, and they got nothing. Money. So if you look at it, our modern just sitting in, what's it for? It makes money. And that's it. No faith, no devotion, talking pranamoya. So pranamoya means economics, morality, and justice. That's its definition. So does that sound familiar with modernity? Yeah, it doesn't matter if it's a devotee or not devotee, it's still the same platform, it's still the same result. So the point is, the Vedic principles are eternal.
I mean, I just find it so funny because we're also very proud in this society of our so-called modern advancements. I mean, you know, we all pride ourselves on, you know, with the whole philosophy that, you know, like, you know, 10,000 years ago, millions of years ago, we're just prehistoric, you know, sort of like animals walking around and whatever. And we just basically just sunk that into society and just brainwash everybody and to say we are the pinnacle of what we've ever become. You know, this is it. We are the most
the
advanced
of human development. I once saw an interesting thing. It's not just once, but I haven't seen it again. You know how they take the Neanderthal man and all that, and then, you know, he's got the cheekbones or this or that, and the low forehead and all whatever he had. Then they take all that and then they take it through what is the normal progression that they would take to get to modern man. And then they always stop. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, from having no nose to, you know, coming up to whatever they had. I saw one thing where they kept it going past to the absurd, you know, as people had this huge, deep nose, and, you know, a forehead like the Simpsons, and little stuff like that, they just kept it going. So, you know, basically, even the pride isn't so much the problem, because pride you can work with. The difficulty is the godlessness, the inability or the unwillingness to see things in connection with God. You know, because it's natural if someone's expert in something, then some pride will be there. But it is something that by etiquette or by relationship you can work with. You know, but the godlessness then throws it into another category, that actually is the real difficulty. That was Bhaktis Tanta says. There's no shortage of anything in this world, the only shortage is self-consciousness. Because technically, if you're connected to Krishna, even the modern stuff doesn't matter. You know what I'm saying? We take cars, we take planes, we take, you know, whatever they've dreamt up, we use it for Krishna. We have no problem with it. Because anything connected to Krishna becomes perfect. At the same time, if everybody was thinking like that, there probably would be not so much need of all this technological. Life is simpler, one doesn't require it. I don't require a car to go from here to somewhere else because I can get everything done in my locale. You know, but the point is, since it's there, we can use it. But, you know, better if it wasn't there to use. The point is that whatever's there is engaged in Krishna's service. So even we don't technically have any problem with the modern. It's only if we make up philosophies about it that, you know, maybe it doesn't work. It's like saying gravity doesn't work. Newton's third law doesn't work anymore. You know, that was what, 200 years ago we dreamt that up. Apples don't drop off the trees anymore, right? They definitely drop farther than they used to, right? They used to not drop so far from the tree, now they drop off. You know, stuff like that, everything's changed.
Interesting, you're saying, you know, that the Achyutananda was asking, where's the book we can read about these things? And just reading through the Krishna book and all the different chapters in the Krishna book, we see how Krishna interacts with different people. Like, you know, one instance I can think of is when he brings in his father's shoes on his head.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like taking that role of being the humble son, and the father is just melted by that and becomes so attracted. And the way he deals with the gopis and stuff. And then the tendency is you see these different pastimes, and we, or at least I understand that Krishna is showing us how to interact with persons in those different relationships, but then the mind just says, yeah, but that's Krishna, he can do it like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's different.
No, Krishna taking the human position. So that culture, that etiquette is what Krishna likes. Right? The animal, he's the humane descendant of Rama. The demigods, they have the mystical aspect, they have the, you know, or as God, you know, that's why everybody means Vaikuntha, people worship you because you're God. The human element is because they like you as a person. That's much nicer. So therefore everyone in Braj, Krishna being God or not God, they couldn't care less. They just like him as a person. He's the nicest person. Therefore they worship him.
And that's because of the way he fosters the relationships with him.
Yeah, I mean that would be how he reciprocates. They have a natural affection for him in that way, and then he reciprocates that. So that naturally then they take the next step. It goes back and forth. In other words, the masculine treats the environment. Right, within that environment, then the feminine responds. It means, you know, takes up some mood, some interest. You know, as we were saying before, there's the field and then there's interest in the field. So the man's created the field, so then the feminine has an interest in that field and wants to therefore interact in a certain way, according to that field. Then the masculine, then, as we see how Krishna does, is he responds to what the feminine wants to. And, you know, the platform they want to interact on within that field. Then having done that, and that inspires them in another way, so it keeps moving. Right? So Krishna's responding to how the devotees are related, you know, how the variety of expression of their affection for him within the field that he's created. So there's a technicality. So that's the fundamentals of how things work. So whether it's in the transcendental platform, material platform, it's still Krishna's energy. And it's still Krishna. So you're still dealing with the same fundamental principles.
He's so expert at it because, see, like, even his relationships with Satyabhama and with me, because they have different moods, he doesn't.
Yeah, because he deals with them according to the mood. Satyabhama is, you know, very left wing. He deals with that. You know, she wants to ride on the bird with him, so, you know, they go for a ride. You know, Rukmini is, you know, very submissive and dealing that. He deals with that. But in both cases, he's active. Right? The left wing forces you to be active. The right wing expects you to be. So what happens is the men all want the right wing woman. They want the left-wing action. But they're unwilling to work for it. So the right-wing woman doesn't respond. You know what I'm saying? But the point is that Krishna is perfect. He is perfectly masculine, so he always is active. He's always taking the active role in the relationship. And he's always basing it on the other. Krishna is trying to please the devotee. That's why the principle in our philosophy is that a sacrifice. That's what Krishna does. He voluntarily, he's God, he doesn't have to, he voluntarily works for the other person's satisfaction. So if we want to move with God, we have to have the same mentality. Transcendental surrender. Right? But it works.
point I'm trying to make, though, in the spiritual world, the love is unconditional, even though Krishna may
that's
treat.
There. That's why here, then you would follow your duties, which is austerity, in the mood of sacrifice. Why is all Gita's talking about Naishkarma, Nishkam Karma Yoga? Perform your duties without a desire for the result. There, spontaneous, they want a good result for Krishna. But here, at least the neutral state is, I do the work without designing it for myself, because I'm just focused on myself. Spontaneous platform is that I'm doing this to please the other person. So therefore, that's why these mechanics have to be discussed and applied. We think, oh, it's so that the why do we have to do this? Why not keep it simple? We would keep it simple, but the problem is the last S stands for stupid. Because we're dedicated to stupidity, therefore it doesn't work simple. Because actually simplicity means you have to be really smart. Right? Masters in any science, they can explain it very simply. Experts absolutely can. So that means simplicity is actually the position of the most intelligent. Because they can cut through all the detail and get right to the essence of actually makes it work. Therefore, that's why then there is following the instructions. So the connection will be made between the material spirit and the spiritual. You have to follow the instructions on how you're going to apply it in your life. But the principle is the same. Principle here, you have one wife. Over there, Krishna is dancing with so many gopis, which has 60,108. That's a detail. So how he deals with one or he deals with them all is the same. That's what God's model. So the point is, do we want to follow God's laws, or do we want to excuse of modernity, you know, God's laws don't work anymore. That's basically what we're dealing with.
Well, we're trying to break them.
Yeah, we're trying to break them. So we use modernity as the method, but the point is the laws still apply. That's all.
But
that's
what,
the foolishness.
Yeah.
Modern means we don't acknowledge God's laws.
But there are many people that say in the future we're going to do it. We're working on it.
I've been saying that for a long time. Future is, you know, so what it is to say. Yeah, I could say in the future I'll be holding on to our lives.
How do we have a relationship with someone and connected to Krishna?
How do you have a relationship with someone and connected to Krishna? One is you follow, means you're going to follow, you know, God's directives. So then, who are you? Are you qualified to have that relationship? Do you have the qualities to perform the duties of that relationship? Do you understand the duties that you have to perform in that relationship? You know, are you going to perform it? Do you know the other person? What is their position? Do they have the qualifications? You know, what is the relationship actually? How do you interact? What are you supposed to do in this relationship? You know what I'm saying? So, that's one aspect. You know, so that's a good place to start.
In different places in the world, there's different conditionings in different countries. So, how do you deal in different countries with different conditionings, and how do you analyze your own and others, and how to interact with Christian culture?
You go by what they expect. Right? You know, you're over here. You know, you meet a couple, you shake the man's hand first, shake the woman's hand. You go to Sweden, you know, you shake the woman's hand first, then the man's hand. That's what they expect of us people. You know, in other words, it's still the same principle of working off the other one's needs and expectations. How they see you, what they expect you are going to fulfill. Right? So if it's a proper relationship, it's proper there, then it's done. If it's not, if it's inappropriate, then, you know, etiquette is there, niceness is there, but it doesn't go there. But it's still the same principle. Because the point is you're still dealing with material energy. That doesn't change. Material energy responds the same way. So it doesn't matter what form it's in, it's still dealing with the same platform. At least like detailed difference, but the principles never change. Right? It's just like you take the man in China, you take the man in Burma, you take the man in Afghanistan, you take the man from Greece, you take the man from Italy, you take the man from Germany, one from France, one from England, one from America, stick them all down, you know, on the table, hand them all a bunch of beers, and say, you know, how's your family life? And they're all going to be making the same complaint. You understand? So that means the principle of relationship is universal. Right? And if you take all of their wives and sit them down like that, they're going to be making exactly the same complaint also. So that's the point, is that relationships are universal. You know how to deal. Otherwise, how is it our, you know, kings from here could, you know, marry apsaras or, you know, from other regions? Because relationship is still the same. Yes.
Is it possible to have perfect relationships in the material world? I mean,
means, perfect means connected to Krishna. But if you're meaning materially perfect, you can get it as materially perfect as material perfection can get. But it still will give no satisfaction to the soul. But that's the idea in the Vedic, is if you deal with the material energy properly, you get the best possible result you can get. Then when you get it, in the beginning you'll be very happy about that, but after a while you get jaded and then you notice that the best result I can get from the material world doesn't in any way compare with the results I get from devotional endeavor. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's like the little kid, you know, he goes out in the backyard and eats the mud, it's fabulous, you know, but after a while, when you compare that to, you know, some sweets or some mother made, then you start to see the difference. You know? And then after a while, they don't eat the mud anymore. That's the idea. So the only reason we're bringing these things up is that, not that it's so important, the technicalities of the material, operating material world, but that devotees take it as important. And because they take it as important, then they're engaged in material activities and they make the serious major mistake of, because their material activities don't go right, they blame Krishna. And they blame devotional service. Big mistake. So therefore, since it's so important to them, why not then learn how to do it right? And the amazing thing is perfectly in line with our philosophy and what's talked about in the books. But the point is if you could work on a higher platform, why get involved so complicatedly with the material energy? But if you are, then at least follow God's laws. Then you'll see, by following His laws, that's what makes it work. Why it's not working is because I'm not following His laws. Then we see as I follow God's laws with material energy, the result I get, and following God's laws with the spiritual energy and what I get, then I start to see that I, as a soul, can actually get more out of the spiritual interaction than out of the material That's been called Vanaprastha. Or the very advanced Grihastha. Does that make sense? So that's why we're bringing it up, because it's a topical thing. Devotees are miserable, their lives are falling apart, they're going away from Krishna, and they're blaming Krishna. So then, we're just trying to turn the heads around. If you want material life, then this is the way to do it. If you don't do it this way, you won't be successful. No ifs, no ands, and no buts.
I know my present situation, and there's a lot of devotees around that sort of fit in that category, I guess. It's sort of in no man's land. I'm not really a brahmachari, I'm not really a grihastha. And I mean, sometimes I don't really know what I should do in terms of, you know, etiquette and respect for the movement, the devotees in general, what I should do, if I should just keep going and try my best and like that. I'm just wondering what you think.
Yeah, the point is one just tries to engage one, sees one's need and tries to engage them. Point is, but still you have to follow the law. You know. That's the main thing. Yeah. Whether you are dealing with people in the temple or dealing with people out of the temple, the matter of dealing is the same. Just one, you're dealing with devotees in devotional service and like that, so it's much nicer. The other ones outside, you're not dealing with that. But if you want it to work, you know what I'm saying? You know, if you're gonna cut the potatoes in Krishna's kitchen to cook for him, you're still cutting it the same way as you do that in a five-star restaurant. But the results you get from cooking for Krishna and cooking for some karmic guy are very different. That's the point. Then you have a commonality you can check. Otherwise, the devotees will say, well, it's not working right because I didn't do it maturity good enough. You know, or because I did it in this way spiritually so it didn't fulfill my needs because they actually didn't do it right. They didn't feel right in the relationship. And so when they leave Krishna consciousness, they're still having the same faults in relationships. But now they've got to blame them on Krishna. That they relax, go out there with some temporary success, and then they'll say, see, all I had to do is be myself, and then you get to come back after 3 years, and then let's see how being yourself is, how ecstasy is. You know, you divorced the devotee you were married to, now you're divorcing the karma, so, you know, tell me which one's better, which one gives you the greatest pleasure. Point is material nature is material nature. Yeah. And it's Krishna's material nature. So it works according to his direction. Maya Chaitra. She works according to his direction, not ours. So if we understand that, then we follow his law in dealing with material energy to fill our material needs. So following his laws means it's still connected to him. So therefore we get the truth of what we're looking for and we get freed from that attachment. And that motive to do it in connection to Krishna, that's service. Dealing with it is not. That's indirect. But the motive to do it for Krishna, that makes it service.
Very good. Thank you, Mark.
So I related to my brahmacharis, and they're always thinking, you know, whether they can argue with their brahmacharya, and they're sort of maybe a bit artificially maybe trying to say brahmacharya, but there's still a strong attraction there after many years. But they don't understand.
Why is it artificial to be a brahmacharya? Since it's one of the four options.
I'm not saying that visual thing, they may be in an artificial state, I think it's still quite...
But let's say you have a kid who has understood when he starts his brahmachari training is going to get married. You know, when he matures. So is it artificial for him to live in the brahmachari state?
No.
then why would it be artificial? The difficulty is he doesn't know how to move in the ashram. He doesn't know the science. Therefore, he's reluctant. So the artificialness is that he's not being trained. You know what I'm saying? Grahastha will say, oh, they're just being artificial. Why don't they just get married? But the real artificial state is being a grahastha and having absolutely no idea what you're doing. Right? And the brahmachari, you mess up your own life and you annoy the temple commander. But, you know, he can go off. He has no connection with you. But if you do that to a woman, then it's a much greater disaster. So who's being artificial? So the point is that it's not that artificial. It's the same principles that make them a good brahmachari are the principles that will make them a good grihastha in the future. But that has to be trained. Prabhupada said, first class brahmachari makes first class grihastha. So that should mean we should be trained to make first class brahmachari. And then from amongst them, some will remain brahmacharis and others will go off and make first class grihastha. That's real. Anything else is artificial. But we're not supporting the brahmachari ashram, we're not trying to make it dynamic, we're not trying to do that. So that means that we want ho-hum brahmachari, therefore we want ho-hum grihasthas. Right? And then we can sit around and lament. You know what I'm saying? Gives you something to talk about. So if we were really caring about the thing, we would see that they're becoming first class brahmacharis.
So if he's, say, a brahmachari still, after many years, still got a strong passion to be able to stay, so at the same time he's thinking...
Would grihasthas have that also?
No.
The point is that you're supposed to cut it down from everything in the universe to one person. You know what I'm saying? So the brahmachari is sitting around there, you know, occasionally checking out the girls, and the grihastha is, you know, checking out the girls. What's the difference? It's not any more illegal for either one of them. Just no one's saying anything to the grihastha doing that, except his wife, if she knows. And they have ways of taking notes. Pretty expert. You know what I'm saying? It's not any better for the consciousness of moving entity and going back to God. Just if it gets too out of hand with, you know, what he saw walking down the street, he does have an alternative with his wife if he knows what he's doing. That's the difference.
I guess what I'm asking is why then should he be encouraged to get married?
But what is the use of encouraging somebody to do something he doesn't know how to do? You know, you encourage him to, you know, jump off the bridge, you know, for a bungee dive, but you haven't told him, you know, the necessary fact that he's supposed to tie that thing around his feet. You know what I'm saying? What's the use? The point is, if you're going to encourage someone to get married, it means you know how to train them how to be married. My point is, the same training applies to everyone. Because the brahmachari training is actually more universal. Like that. If you have an interesting head, I had a grihastha lecture, you know, discussions on grihastha ashram. I think there were maybe 10, 12 people came. Like that. Grihasthas more men than women. We had a brahmachari seminar. I'd say the women were 2 to 1 to the men. And every day it grew more and more and more and more women came. And we were just discussing brahmachari. Brahmachari ashram. Brahmachari life. Brahmachari nature. That's more attractive to the women than, you know, these burnt out, you know, their husbands. Why? Because there's life. There's service. There's humility. All the qualities they're looking for in their husband, the brahmacharis got. And then when those brahmacharis become grihasthas, they feel, I don't have to act like that anymore. I'm the Lord of the Creator. vacation. And therefore, the women lose interest in him. So if that's understood, that these principles of Brahmacharya ashram are supposed to continue in Grihastha ashram. In other words, it's not the sex or no sex. It's the dealings, it's the character, it's the mentality. Then it would be successful Grihastha. That's what Thomas Baba said. Successful Brahmacharya will be a successful Grihastha. Because the same principles apply. So it has to be a complete package, right? Someone in the Grihastha community does something wrong, oh, morally, this, that, they throw them out of the community. But did that community do one drop to train them in what was the right standard, show them, teach them, show them practical ways to apply it? I guarantee it is zero. And then they so righteously throw them out. Where does that come from? That comes from pride. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't come from Krishna consciousness. It doesn't come from Vaishnava anything. It doesn't come from understanding relationships. It simply comes from the common pride. And how can anyone be comfortable and secure in that? In other words, you're worried about the Brahmacharya ashram that they should be married, then train them as good Brahmacharyas, that when they get married, you will be successful. If you think you should be married, make sure he's a good Brahmacharya beforehand. Make sure he knows who he's getting into. Make sure he knows how to translate service, you know, in the temple, you know, what that means, service in the house. He submits to the temple commander, he's the one that has needs. If you submit it to the wife, she's the one with needs. Train them in that. Then it's worth talking about. Okay. So then, Shri Prabhupada ki jai.